broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, guys. Happy Friday. How are you all?
Good morning.
Very well, thank you.
Morning, Steph. Morning.
Good morning.
How you doing?
We've actually got a very special guest with us today. His name is Paul Oster, and he's the principal of Reignite Consulting. So welcome, Paul, to the show today. We're going to hear a little bit from you today.
That's it. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the time.
Yeah, that'd be great. Good. And
welcome, how guys? Sorry, guys. I'm just saying it's good to have a guest for the first time on our virtual podcast.
Yeah, it is good to have a guest. Not that I'm overseeing your faces in the morning, but it's always nice to have somebody else in the mix. How are you guys going with the restrictions easing? I think we're going to have a little bit of a chat about this morning, but obviously, a few outbreaks in Victoria, but there are a lot of advertisements talking about reopening. So maybe, Joel, I might throw over to you. You've been quite vocal on this topic. So.
Thanks, Steph. You put me right in the deep end here. Look, I guess I was quite shitty when I heard the news on Saturday afternoon that it looked like the restrictions were going to be extended. I've probably got a vested interest. We live in the city, and the city of Melbourne is dead. It's lost its heart and its soul over the last 3 months. I know that it's probably not the experience that's happening out in the suburbs, but as somebody who enjoys the cosmopolitan feel of living in the city and having all the restaurants and cafes shut down, and my favourite pubs, that was really quite heartbreaking to see that we're going to have to wait another 3 weeks or so before we can actually get out there and have a beer and watch the football. And I was also hoping that that I might be able to go and attend some football games as well, given that Collingwood are second on the ladder and have started the season as well as what they have. But no, that looks like it might be in jeopardy as well. So, it was a little bit heartbreaking, a little bit frustrating. I might have said a couple of things about a socialist utopia down in Melbourne and whatever it might have been, but... Nevertheless, it is where we are.
Yeah, but they really pulled that one from us. They just got us excited about being able to re-enter football stadiums, and then they, in Victoria, they just took it away again.
Yeah, and they're doing door-to-door testing now. I was reading on the news this morning, so house knocking on your door and bringing a coronavirus kit to you.
Dan Andrews has pulled out the playbook from many other great socialist nations. He's brought the army in.
Yeah.
I did have stuff on the news. They were saying that the police are not not used to arrest people or for doing the wrong thing. They're arresting people fishing on their own while coronavirus is on, but they've brought the army in to stop people from escaping from hotels. So.
I've got to stand up for what's going on, though, because what we know from last time is the capacity for numbers to escalate. And the numbers in the last few days have been above 20 and 30. If we go back 1 and 2 weeks ago, the daily escalation was in the tens. We know from last time that if the increase in cases is in the teens this week, in 2 weeks' time, you can add a zero to that. The way the government's looking at this is very much in three-week increments. They go through a three-week period of time. They make a decision what's going to be the settings for people going out and about for the next 3 weeks, and then they reassess, and every 3 weeks they have a block. Obviously, they've seen, okay, we've got a rate of escalation here. What do we want the number of cases to be in 3 weeks' time? Oh, we don't want them to be 100 cases per day. Okay, well, we need to change the settings. And unfortunately, we need to go through this tightening so that we don't get that rate of escalation.
Well, Louis, I just want to take you up on that, right? Because and this is a healthy debate, right? And
yes.
This, you know, we should be able to speak it. But What is the goal of these lockdowns? Because my concern is that we were told that these lockdowns initially were supposed to give us a chance for the medical system to catch up, to be able to handle the influx of patients going into emergency rooms and intensive care units. But it seems to me that, you know, when we've got 20, which, you know, 20 a day, little hotspots breaking out, we knew that hotspots were going to break out as we started to relax some of these restrictions. It seems to me that the goalposts have changed and that the government is trying to move towards eradication, which is almost going to be impossible given the high number of people that have that are asymptomatic. So if the goal of having these lockdowns was to give the health system a chance to catch up and be able to deal with an influx of cases and treat those people so we gave them the best chance of recovery, well, we've achieved that because the emergency rooms and intensive care units are basically dead at the moment because there's no elective surgery. There's none of those unimportant surgeries taking place right now. And the intensive care units are basically, you know, empty of people with coronavirus issues. And if we're going for a goal of eradication, that's going to be almost impossible in an environment where you don't have a vaccine. So this is where I start to wonder, are we now striving for something that is not attainable and could now be starting to do more damage and intensify the pain and elongate the pain that many businesses are going through? And is this now unnecessary?
Yeah, great question, Joel. My take on it is this is now becoming a bit of an economic juggle. And my take on that is if you have around about 10 new cases per day, so let's give round numbers per week. So let's say around about 100 new cases in a week, you've now got probably 50 to 100 households that are now shut down and have to be in isolation for a period of probably close to a month. You got to be shut down for, or more than a month, you got to be shut down for your whole period of time of having coronavirus and then for 14 days after symptoms disappear. So if you've got 100 households shut down for a month, then that's a certain number of employees that can't go to their business, a certain number of kids that can't go to school, and it takes out from the community. And I think 100 per week, well, that's pretty economically manageable. What they are trying to prevent is an escalation of adding another zero. 1,000 per week, if you've now got 500 or 800 households where you've got a husband and a wife both working, you've now got 500 to 800 employees coming out of the workforce, and the risks that go on with that, because for every confirmed case, you've now got a workplace. They might shut down the whole workplace, which might be a whole construction site for a number of days. It might be an entire office building for a couple of days. It might be an entire childcare center for a couple of days. And when it's only 100 per week, yeah, okay, there's a certain economic cost which is palatable. But if it's 1,000 a week, then the cost is probably not palatable. I don't know exactly what that number is, but when we're looking at it in 3-week blocks and the potential number of cases over that period of time, I think it is an economic argument as to where that ideal number of cases lies.
So I think we're at about 138 live cases at the moment. Even if that got to 1,380 cases, or even 13,800 cases, that's still a drop in the ocean in regards to our economy. And when you're talking about a death rate at this point in time that's probably now less than 1%, I think, in Victoria, I think that now that we're at that point where we need to start thinking about what longer term damage is this going to do? I think most people were accepting of the fact that 3 months, okay, let's take the medicine, let's you know, bite the pill, and let's see whether or not we can try and stop this out and get on top of it. And I think by and large we're on top of it. We're always going to deal with hotspots, and the narrative that was given to us, which I think was sold to us and most people accepted, was give ourselves a chance to get on top of this and be able to manage it, because until we find a vaccine, we're not going to eradicate it. Now we're at that point where we are on top of it. We are going to have those flare-ups. We can manage those flare-ups if we're quick and we're doing the tracing and we can shut those areas down. I'm now, you know, sort of thinking about, well, you know, if this goes on for a lot longer, what longer term impacts does it have on our government's ability to help us from the next crisis? What impacts does that have on people who have lost their businesses and shut down, people who now have to go onto JobKeeper and onto JobSeeker, and then onto the Dole. People have lost their identity because they no longer can run their businesses. And, you know, I know that, you know, what about the financial stresses that it creates on people who are now, you know, got facing the prospect of not being able to go back and earn the same amount of money that they were earning prior to the shutdowns, and having to meet mortgage repayments and disrupt families that, you know, could potentially lose their homes as a result of an unnecessary extension. I'm at the point where I start to feel a little bit skeptical around 180 live cases and 20 a day in a society where we've got around about 5.5 to 6 million, you know, in just one state. It feels to me like that's a drop in the ocean, and we should be able to more than easily be able to manage that. But hey, I'm just an outsider looking in. So
I was actually going to ask Paul about your thoughts on this as well, because you've got school age children that have been through this as well with you. You've got your own business. How has it sort of affected you, and what are your thoughts around what's going on?
Well, with the numbers themselves, I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that the silly thing about this virus spreading thing or anything like this is that you have exponential growth. So, you know, we're talking 20s or 30s and so on. But if you have to plot these things on a semi-log graph, which I think there's a couple of websites that do that and can show you great numbers as to, you know, just where we're at. And what you're looking for, the weird thing about this virus spreading is it ends up being a doubling. And what you're looking for is how fast does it double. So you literally have to plot things on a semi-log graph. So we can't use a linear argument. We have to use an exponential analysis. And, well, the thing is that we just have to make sure that it doesn't gallop away on us. That's the weird thing about it. This thing, you know, it's you know, whatever this bug is, it's invisible, it's nasty, it lasts a lot longer on surfaces than you normally think. It's easy to transmit. People can walk around and transmit it without having it and all that kind of weird stuff. I mean, it's a pretty nasty little bug that we just had to make sure that we contain. And when we're dealing with exponential growth, it's very hard to get our arms around, well, how do we control it? And how, you know, what happens when it gets out of our hands? That's the problem. So that's where the numbers come in. From as far as being a dad with kids, look, it hasn't been easy for them. Kids have been learning from school, and to be fair, you know, I know people talk about homeschooling. Well, it's not really homeschooling. You're just trying to help facilitate the children to learn online. Yeah. We have two children, 14 and 8. The 14-year-old is fine. She's an excellent student, finds a great way to communicate with friends, and that, in fact, actually found some benefits to learning online because you didn't have all the distractions of the classroom, you know, all the fun stuff in the background, you know, throwing paper airplanes at each other, whatever you normally do in a classroom. She said, I could just focus on work. So she loved it. For the little one, the 8-year-old, it was harder because she relies more on a social interaction. It's very hard to be social online. And if you're used to those different stimuli and those different interactions as part of your learning or the feedback, you know, the teacher looking over your shoulder or whatever, to get, you know, you stick up your hand and ask for help whenever you need it. She wasn't getting as much of that, so that was a little more of a struggle for her. Balancing, well, it's, you know, you got what you got, right? What do you do? The first thing you do is you upgrade your internet speed so that you can handle, you know, four people doing Zoom chats or Microsoft Teams chats, you know, at the same time, and hopefully the thing doesn't fall over. That's one hope. The second thing is as well, what can we do, as a business person to balance all this stuff? Because I imagine a lot of the listeners will be saying, well, you know, yeah, that's great. I'm running my office in here, but the kids are out there. I got to keep them fed. I got to keep them interested. So there is a balancing act. I think one of the great things is, you know, people like the City of Melbourne have been awarding grants to help businesses like mine move online. And I'll stick my hand up and say I've actually been awarded one of those grants. And so I'm now in a process of transitioning some more of my businesses online for the future.
Yeah.
And that's a way of, you know, spreading yourself out and keeping yourself balanced. Now, people say, well, you know, how can you do business like that? It is different. All right. I had to look, I'm a business coach. I do meet people in person. I like to talk across the desk with people or do things on the whiteboard or scribble things on a plan in front of me or whatever. I can't do that. So we're doing it online. It has its pluses, it has its minuses, but at least we can do something. But you say, well, how can you pivot with that? The biggest thing is finding new business. Because people have to know, like, trust you. To do that, you have to interact with them somehow. If you don't know them, it's very hard to reach out to a new strange person, especially online, online, because we have so many blockers, so many filters, and everything else to stop strange people banging on our door, because some of them might be, you know, not nice people. You know, So the honest people try and knock on the door and say, I want to offer some business. That's not there. So what do you do? You have to pivot and say, well, okay, it's literally going through referral networks. Now, I'm a member of BNI. For those of you in business, Networking International is a great group where business people meet once a week to basically learn more about each other's businesses and try to refer them business. And through that network, I've been able to expand all over the place. And at the end of the day, my numbers are actually better than before the COVID virus.
Is that right?
Well, I'm reaching out to new markets. I've just landed before the virus, I was in Melbourne. I was doing one-to-one coaching. And that was fine, and things are going up incrementally, and that's fine. Now I've got people interstate. Why? Because somebody knew somebody who knew somebody who mentioned I need a business coach, and all of a sudden we're talking, and all of a sudden we're doing business. And I would not normally have reached out to somebody in Sydney.
Yeah.
I've got another client in Singapore. I'm talking to somebody in Saudi Arabia. And I mean, I didn't expect that. But once you are online, you can be anywhere. Mm. And that's great. It opens you up to a broader audience. The other thing I have people do is, well, all right, what do you do with your offer, with your package? Now, there are three categories, especially in consulting, but I'm sure it applies to a lot of people. There's do it for you, do it with you, do it yourself. So I spent my one-to-one business coaching. It tends to be do it with you. We work together on trying to come up with some solutions, whatever it is. That's great. But what's told me is that, Paul, the people you used to sell to, don't forget, before they had the money, but they often didn't have the time. So if you got a meeting with them to hopefully sell them something, you had 20 minutes, and they said, excuse me, Paul, I got to run. I got to get into town and get the next meeting. Now, that's not the problem. Most people are stuck at home, right?
Yeah.
But they don't have the cash. As you said, you know, you brought up before, hey, you know, it's pinched some way or another. Your business has been restricted. So what do you do? So you have these people with all the time, not so much cash. So what do we do? Well, the way you do it is they said, can you somehow offer them a lower cost product, but give them a tool or something so they can do it themselves because they got the time? So what we did was we developed a group coaching product. So I said much lower price to say, hey, you're part of a group. Come in. There's the social interaction. But also, I'll give you tools every week to go and apply to your business and come back to me next time we get together and tell me what you did. And that's been very successful.
Yeah.
And not only that, we've engaged a whole lot of people I might have not engaged in the face-to-face coaching because, of course, coaching comes at a price. And so it's learning how to adjust your product to meet people where they're at. You know, what can we do if they are, as I say, if they are time rich, cash poor, what can I offer them in bite-sized chunks that they can afford, that they can apply to their business and they get benefit out of? And that's where we've been getting a lot of growth from.
Do you ever think that it will go back to the way that things were with your business? Or do you think this has fundamentally shifted things forever?
It will become a hybrid. The reality is people will still like to go and meet in person and do all the things we used to do. And that's great. But the reality is, I mean, my client in Sydney will be on Zoom for the most part because it is. The fact that we're reaching people in other countries, the fact that we're reaching people at different times. So we know that we have, you know, as you said, if you have children that you're taking children back and forth to school, you know, you obviously can't do business at those times. But what it enabled me to do was once I have the kids home, because I can then switch into an online mode. I don't have to be at a place of work. I can be home. The kids can be doing what they got to do, you know, before dinner. I'm actually having more coaching calls.
Yeah.
But I'm doing them online. Yeah. So
how do you protect your mental state, though, with doing this? Is it created a lot more work for you? And how do you balance out your work time and also your personal time? Because for me, I feel that my worlds have blended.
Yes. It's very hard. The people tell me that my days just go into each other now. I don't have the separation between the work week and the weekend or my regular, quote, 9 to 5 into the evening time. That has really blurred. What I tell people to do is I ask them to use a tool called a default diary. So in other words, you literally plan out your week ahead of time and say, well, how would my week work ideally? And block it out. Say, look, I'm going to be getting up early. I'm going to be working out or watching inspirational or business videos first thing in the morning. Then we get the kids and everything else ready for breakfast, and we feed them, get them changed, get ready for school, whatever it is. And you start blocking out your time, and you say, okay, a rich time for me is between 9, let's say, and 2:30. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have to pick up kids, you know, this funny situation we're in, you have to pick up kids. Okay, 9 to 2:30, we just map out sales calls are here, you know, 9 to 10, and, you know, 10 to 12 might be coaching situations and a bit of lunch, and then it's on. So you actually block out your days to make sure that, you know, you work during the work and you're with the kids when you're with the kids and so on. And that way you start to have control over your life. Now, there are days that it's going to go pear-shaped.
Yeah.
There are days the whole thing's going to fall in a heap. Some disasters happen and you just have to drop everything and fix it. But if you can keep to that most of the time, again, I find my clients start to get back control in their life. And that gives them some break from what you described. It starts to block out their time. It starts to give them a business life and a personal life because they're making the time for it. They're sticking to the diary. Yeah. So that's one tool I suggest for people.
That's good advice. Really good advice. The other question I had that you mentioned off the podcast before was that obviously a lot of people are out of work at the moment.
Yes.
But you see it as a very good time to actually start hiring really good staff. Can you talk to me a little bit more about what you see there?
Yeah. The beautiful thing is that, hey, if you're a business that has any cash coming in at all and you're not looking bad, look, it's not going to be as healthy as it used to be, but hey, it's not looking bad. This is the time to get the best talent going. Unfortunately, a lot of very good, deserving companies, unfortunately, through the trials of this health emergency, have had to let people go, good people go. And as a result, if you're recruiting, My clients are coming up with some absolute stunners to add to their staff. So the people that can, I say, for gosh sakes, go through these people, put it out there. There's some great people out there. Hire them. Because you can then start to put together your A team. And what does that mean? Well, when the green light finally goes on and this health emergency is in the past, you're going to be out of the blocks and we won't see you for dust. Why? Because your competition's left with the B team. You've got the best people going. You're going to run and kick all these goals. You're going to do some amazing things out there, and you'll leave the competition for dust. And I'm not there to trash anybody. I'm just saying we have to take advantage of the opportunity that presents itself. And, hey, I'm more of a philosophy of there's plenty of fish in the sea, so there's something for everybody here. So I'm trying to encourage anybody, if you can, for God's sakes, reach out there. This is the time to hire if you can afford to hire. Put them to work. You have some very smart people working for you that are very thankful to have that position. And they'll work twice as hard as they normally would because they say, hey, I want to make sure I keep this job and keep the company afloat. So that's I'm encouraging people. It's interesting. I had a guy who's a Sparky. He's really blowing up in the solar space. So a lot of people are putting up solar panels right now, commercial and industrial people. So big installations. He's got competitors going up to him saying, hey, son, you know, I've got a couple of crews here. Can you use a couple of crews? Can we subby them out to you? Because otherwise, I'm going to have to let them go, and they're great people. So he's got his pick of the best. Mm-hmm. He's got the best crews right there with him. Because those guys are going to stick around. If they say this guy can produce even in bad times, hey, we're going to stick around with that guy.
Yeah.
So he's got his pick of the great stuff out there.
Yeah, incredible. Certainly really good advice. And another way of sort of looking at this pandemic is an opportunity, really. So good advice there. Look, we're going to throw to a really quick break and we're going to come back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
So welcome back, guys. We now want to just throw it over again to Paul. Now, I just wanted to talk a little bit about your background. You're the principal of Reignite Consulting. You're also a rocket scientist by background, and you've come from Toronto originally. How on earth did you get from a rocket scientist into consulting in the first place?
Well, that's interesting. Yes, it is a bit of a journey. And yes, I'm a real rocket scientist. I've had stuff go up on the space shuttle and be brought back home. So that was a fascinating experience as it was.
Humans, were you able to bring them back home?
No, it was a big story. No, just samples. No, I wasn't that big. No, I only did samples. My specialty was reinforced plastics. So your carbons, fiberglass, Kevlars, borons, whatever it is, you know, these very modern space age, lightweight, super strong materials. Fantastic. And the question came up, they said, well, we make spaceships out of this stuff, but what really happens in space? And of course, we had done the, you know, your typical tests, your tensions, your compressions, you crush them, you twist them, you vibrate them, you put them in vacuum, you hit them with the radiation and everything else. We kind of got, you know, we kind of understand what happens, but they said, but what actually happens in space? Because it's a mixture of those things. So they did. So we went, so we actually, our lab wasn't my experiment. It was, you know, I was part of an experiment, but I made some of the samples that went up on an experiment that was dropped off by the space shuttle and stayed in Earth orbit for a few years. Yeah, right. So we can just sit there and say, let's see what happens. Because, of course, our space stations stay up there for a few years. Mm-hmm. So we got to want to make sure there's something weird that happens. Hey, we got guys up there in the space station, right? We don't want the space station to fall apart. Yeah. So that's what they wanted to know. And the funniest thing is when we brought them back home, the funniest thing they found out was the samples were sandblasted.
Really?
Sandblasted. Nobody ever expected that. And they said, well, sandblasted. Tell me about this. And what happened was they could figure out from the angle of the sandblasting that it came from the sun. Because the sun is out there giving out tons of energy and radiation and all those good things that send out, you know, keep the Earth warm and all those good things, right? But it also sends out micrometeorites.
Really?
So you get these very fine sand particles at a bit of speed, strikes the surface. Huh. So the silly things were sandblasted in the angle at which it was aimed towards the sun. So the next level of testing, you know, after I left, the next level of testing was then to say, well, what does that mean? Does it weaken the structure? Do we have to put coatings on it or whatever? Yeah. But anyway, that was the final, the funny learning from that.
Yeah, right. Amazing.
What was what did they want to do after that? Once they got these samples back, what's the whole scenario?
Well, then you go and say, well, let's check their strength after being up there. Does it degrade? Does it wear out? You know, do these things gradually weaken over time? And if so, by how much? And then start to bake that into your design. So you make whatever it is, a bit thicker, a bit different, or you put a protective layer on it to avoid the sandblasting or whatever. That's what you do that for.
Right. And how, doing all those crazy experiments, did you get into consulting? Is there some kind of link that I don't know about here?
It is rather weird. Well, you have to understand I was a bit mad about trying to go to Australia anyway.
Yeah.
And check it out. But at the time, the only place I was hiring was Ford Australia. So Ford actually up in Broadmeadows. And the link was they had a future products division. Mm-hmm. So they find a gap in the marketplace. Now it might be the next Falcon. But also is they would find a new gap in the marketplace that Ford didn't have a product. So they say, well, do we have something that we can ship from Ford into the Australian market to look after that niche? No. Well, okay, probably not. Well, go to America. Their cars are quite different than what we have here. Probably not. Go to Europe. Some of them fit, some of them don't. So who can we partner with? So this particular group, now I didn't do it, but some particular group, or this particular group went and actually knocked on the door of Mazda, which at the time was 33% owned by Ford. And they said, hey, you know that thing we now call the Mazda 3? You know, well, we'd like to go and take that and put our own body around it. You know, keep the chassis, you guys keep the chassis, you guys keep the powertrain and everything else. But we'll build a separate body around it, call it a Ford, call it the Laser, and we'll bring it out here, and that'd be great. Well, Mazda loved it because it increased their volume. Here in the marketplace, it came out, it was a total game changer because it came out fully loaded, Japanese quality, 13,990 driveway.
Yeah.
And blew the doors off the place.
I remember the Ford Lasers. Yep.
Yep. So that's what this group did. It actually found these unusual opportunities and helped the company make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that's this group. Now, the point of the story is, the connection is, this group was staffed with aerospace engineers.
Right. Okay.
So I was one of about six or seven of them in there, which is quite a fascinating background because, you know, they're regular engineers. You know, designing cars is a very prescriptive business because of all the demands legally and legislation-wise about, you know, emissions and crash testing and you name it. You're very much designed in a box. But they need people that understood engineering but thought outside of the box, and that's why they had aerospace engineers in there. Yeah, right. So that's how I got into it. But during the time, they trained me in business, which is fantastic. So Ford is fantastic that way. They got me an MBA along the way. Now, I tell you right now, I couldn't afford an MBA at the time, but they paid for it. So, hey, I'm very happy with them.
Thank you, Ford.
Thank you, Ford. Absolutely. Well, they gave me a second career. Yeah. So that when it was clear which way Ford was going, I was able to step out into a management consulting role. And then I ended up going around the world working for or serving clients who were Fortune 500 companies. I worked about nine different countries, often for months at a time, which was amazing stuff. Then I ended up working on my own. You know, that company eventually closed down. So I ended up working on my own and got into helping companies with business growth because that seemed to be the real issue they were dealing with. They knew that there was an opportunity. They wanted to grow. They didn't know how, or they topped out. They couldn't grow any further, or there was just so much happening. They had explosive growth, and they couldn't contain it. They couldn't control it. They couldn't manage it. So that's where I ended up developing my specialty.
And I was just reading just some of your information. It's not just small businesses. It's medium-sized businesses as well. You seem to cater for quite a lot of businesses.
That's right. At the end of the day, the problem's the same. So the size of the business just says, well, how deep do we go and how many more people do we have to involve and in what sort of areas? So I deal with everything from entrepreneurs that it might just be a Sparky on his own, all the way through to, as I say, mid-sized companies that can be $2 to $3 million. They can have several staff. They're importing or they're exporting. And I every so often get into larger companies, which might have hundreds of staff. But the CEO brings me and says, Paul, we have a particular issue. Can you help us sort out a particular issue? And so I help the CEO identify the issue, work with their teams in that to crystallize all the inputs into that issue, map it out for everybody, and propose some solutions. So that's more of a traditional consulting role. So I get those from time to time.
So, Paul, is the classic problem that brings a client to you, is it how do I get more customers? Or is there other motivators that bring clients to you?
The biggest thing for people, of course, is watching the dollars. You know, yeah. At the end of the day, they look at company performance. And it could be a lot of things. You know, one client, the market changed. So here's a guy imports lights for distribution in Australia. Mm. But our distribution channels are changing. So the wholesalers and so on do not, purchase in the quantities they used to. And you say, well, and in fact, some of them are closing down. He says, but people still need to buy lights. How do I get lights out to the marketplace? So part of our work is saying, well, let's find out where the customers are. How do they buy now? And how can we engage them to purchase our product?
All different types of businesses. Do you have specific businesses that come to you? Have there been one industry more than another that's actually approached you?
Yes, they do fall in certain categories. I mean, it's not limited to this. So if somebody doesn't fit into one of these categories, hey, I still talk to them. Hey, give me coffee. I'll do anything for you. but what I they fall in a couple of categories. A lot of trades. So electricians, plumbers, cleaners, people who are hands-on with work because they understand the model. They say, look, we've done an apprenticeship to learn what we have to learn to then go out on our own. This is our business apprenticeship. So they understand the model. They understand what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve. That's great. We've had a new upswing in professionals. So accountant or lawyer who's done good in some big Collins Street practice, but eventually gets a better position out in the suburbs. Why? It's not the hard driving route of Collins Street. You know, probably a little more money, probably a little more relaxations, saner hours. But they're then told, hey, you're responsible for your own sales. They've never done it before. They have to effectively build a business within the practice. Well, they call me in to help them with that. I've also dealt with a lot of people in, you know, anything connected to the internet. So IT services, digital marketing, a lot of people like that. Why? Very high growth, trying to cope with scale.
Yeah.
And people say, well, is that real? You know, I had one client or customer tell me, he said, well, Paul, I don't know. We've been growing at 5% a year. I said, are you happy being below average? not too good, which is a part of the point. And I said, well, do you realize, according to the industry reports, the average growth rate, I'm saying average, is 13% a year. Right. And it's forecast to be that for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Would you like some help to become average? And people say, well, Paul, is that real? You know, can you really do that? I said, well, average. I said, it's average. Yeah. I worked with a few years ago, I worked with a large university group recruiting students from overseas into Australia to learn university, right, in a university subjects. Fantastic. They had some big industry guru get up at a conference. I was actually in the conference. And they said, you know, for the next 20 years, we're forecasting growth of 4.5% per year. And I kid you not, you could literally see everybody write down 4.5%. And you knew that every paper for approval that go up to the board would say 4.5%. Why? Because that guy's smart and he said so. We got our client to grow at 45% a year.
Wow.
They actually, that means you're doubling every 2 years.
Yeah.
With the number of students you got in. Mm. And you say, well, so what? They actually had to turn into a real estate company. Because they're running out of space to train all the kids. So they had to start leasing more and more buildings in town to stick the kids in so you can teach them all the good stuff. Because now that they got them, you got to teach them, right?
Yeah.
So that's the kind of changes I've worked with, you know. Right. So you don't have – just because it's average doesn't mean you have to be average. You can be better than average, and that's what we try to do.
Yeah. And can I ask you, too, just on package – like the packages that you sort of offer, how can somebody get in contact with you and what are the range of packages that you provide?
Well, it ends up being, the packaging ends up being a good, better, best scenario. So we do have the promotional or the professional level, which is an entry-level product. And that for that that kind of company, they might be literally man in the van. It could be, as I said, accountant, on their own trying to build a practice. The next level up would be more of the business person package where they do have more of a business, they have staff, they have some systems in place and they're trying to grow. And then we have the more of an executive package, which is, hey, you're now the CEO, you might be offering several different products to the marketplace through several different teams and you want to grow further and say, well, where should we go? Where should we grow? How should we go there? If we're going to export, how do we want to represent ourselves in that foreign country? What are our options? And so we get into different questions there. So that's the top package.
And just before we throw to a quick break, what's your email address or what's the website that we can get in touch with you?
Fantastic. It's all available through reigniteconsulting.com.au. And if you just sent a note to Paul at reigniteconsulting.com.au, I'll certainly welcome it, and we can see if we can meet up and help you out.
Fantastic.
All right. Thank you so much for that information. We're going to now throw to a quick break and we'll come back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Do you have something else that you wanted to...
No. I was just conscious of the time, hun.
Yeah, so how did you want to end it up today? Because I'm just thinking...
Well, I think what we probably do is we just thank Paul very quickly for his input and ask him to hang around until the end. And then we might quickly throw it over to Louis to talk about his important update on the tax strategies, throw it around to Brett on an important update in regards to real estate, and then we get into the...
Brett disappeared on my screen.
No, I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Look, I mean, you can skip me altogether today. What I've got isn't really time critical or that relevant, so happy to avoid it.
Well, let's just close out with Louis' topic then.
And then you can't be serious. So we'll quickly thank Paul for hanging around. Throw into Louis, and then we'll do the you can't be serious.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, welcome back, guys. And thank you so much, Paul, for all your input today. It was great to hear about your business and just to get those little tips that, you know, how to actually really get ahead after coronavirus and what to do to really excel and grow your business. So thank you. We'd love you to hang around. We're now going to actually throw over to Louis. Louis is going to talk to us a little bit more about throwing off from a topic that we previously spoke about. It's the tax office with information on the recontribution tax strategy.
It's the topic that won't die. We're coming back to it a third time. And for some context, financial planners around Australia, including us, became really excited about a strategy when the government announced the ability for certain people to withdraw $10,000 from their super for responding to the coronavirus situation. And financial advisors identified, well, if you can get $10,000 of cash outside of super, why don't you put $10,000 of cash back into super and claim a tax deduction on it for those people who still have the taxable income and don't otherwise need that money in their pocket.
It's still good news, Lee, right? Because this is my favourite topic.
So then I came back in another episode and said, oh, well, the tax office is sort of indicating that they don't really like it, but they haven't given any specific reason or any specific guidance. They're just putting out memes and infographics and things saying it's generally speaking a bad idea. Finally, in the last week, I have found on what grounds the tax office would go after people and some clearer language. Well, sort of clearer language, because they've come out with some kind of press release which has triggered some news articles.
Okay.
And this is a classic scare campaign where they say, if you do activity A, then we don't like it. And by the way, if you do activity B, there's actually a penalty for it because it's clearly illegal. So the headline of this of a number of news articles is 2 million Australians at risk of a $12,000 fine. Now, that's not going to apply to this recontribution strategy, but by putting the two matters in the same article, they're creating fear around it. 2 million Australians is the number of Australians who have made the withdrawal. Are they at risk of a $12,500 fine? No, they're not, because the majority of those $2 million Australians have made this withdrawal legitimately. It's the people who have made false declarations, people whose incomes haven't reduced or their work hours haven't reduced. They're the people who are at risk because they're basically lying. If you lie, then you're up for this penalty. But then because they're saying in the same breath, by the way, we don't like this recontribution strategy, there's a lot of fear around it. So in some deep diving into the bowels of the ATO website, finally I get some examples and some guidelines around how they might go after people. It is what I thought it would be. It's under the general anti-avoidance rule for income tax, which is known as Part 4A of the tax law. And it does specify there that they are going to have a close eye on anyone who has withdrawn from super and contributed to super in the same year. Mm. And if they find that people have done these actions purely to get a tax benefit, then they are going to unwind any benefit that you get. They're basically going to cancel your tax deductions. They could also apply some kind of penalty. I don't know what that penalty would be, but I imagine it's some kind of slap on the wrist. Again, it comes back to, well, what was your intent at the time of taking the action? Was your primary purpose to get a tax benefit, or was your primary purpose for something different? And it's going to be difficult for the ATO to prove. So for people who are doing it, just be aware of what your intent is, and it might be helpful to document what your intent is. And then if your intent changes at a different time, well, then document that as well. Just keep some notes. What if you have already taken the action? What if you got excited back in April or May and already went straight ahead, took $10,000 out and put $10,000 back in? Well, there's a pretty simple solution for that if you're starting to think you've done the wrong thing. When you contribute $10,000 back into super, if you don't want the tax deduction anymore, you don't have to take the tax deduction. Right. So by putting $10,000 into super, you claim a tax deduction when that contribution is considered a concessional contribution, and that's what entitles you to the tax deduction. If you don't want that anymore, just call that recontribution a non-concessional contribution. And by doing that, you don't have to claim the tax deduction off your personal tax. And if the ATO knocks on the door, which they won't, but if they theoretically did, they'd knock on your door, say, you've done this for a tax benefit. And then you'd say, I did not claim the tax deduction, therefore there is no tax benefit. And then everything's even, and there's no benefit, therefore there's no penalty or unwinding of anything. So that's my final resolution. Putting the men to bed. I'm calling it done. That's it.
No, that's good advice, and especially when you have to dig deep on that website to find any information, because it hasn't really been that clear. So thank you for clarifying that.
Correct. So, just to make the actions really clear, if you've already done the withdrawal and the recontribution, it's okay. Don't panic, because these actions you just take at the time of doing your personal tax return or earlier. So you don't have to do the final actions before the end of financial year, but it comes down to what goes on your tax return and what declaration you make to your super fund. Yeah. So on your tax return, you do the one thing and you tell your super fund that this is not a tax deductible contribution. There's two things together, means that there's no tax benefit.
Good advice, Louis. Hopefully we never have to revisit it again.
I hope so.
All right. Well, look, guys, we're going to throw over to our last segment for the day, and that's your favorite. It's You Can't Be Serious. I'm sure that you've all been looking for things online. Joel, do you want to start? You always seem to have one.
My one today is a little bit lame, but it's still pretty good with a happy ending. No, Brett, don't go there, my friend. a gentleman in Lutwyche in Queensland, in Brisbane, had just won the top Powerball jackpot the other day. When was it? On the 24th of June. The man won $500,000 in the lotto, but when he found out that he'd actually won the lotto, he'd made such a ruckus, he'd screamed the house down so badly that neighbors rushed over to his house to check that everything was okay. And that was it.
That was great, Joel. Excellent. That's made a punchline there. And there
wasn't one. No punchline.
Excellent.
Fuck.
Brett, are you there? I can't actually see you on the screen.
That's cool, Steph. I'm here. Yeah, look, I saw something during the week that garnished a lot of support on social media. A hardworking mother had a rant because she'd been working from home, homeschooling her kids all at the same time as moving house, and her one stress relief was a glass or two of wine at the end of the day. But she was pretty disappointed when all of the online shopping she's had to do to get groceries home, they had the right to substitute products. And one of them was the wine they'd substituted for a lower alcohol content.
Oh,
God. Her over the edge.
I think most mothers can relate to having a drink, certainly through what's been going on at the moment. And dads as well.
Huh? Yep. I think a lot of people can relate. And look, just another quick one. We spoke earlier about the levels of COVID-19 cases in Victoria. I think we could follow Donald Trump's lead. If we reduce the number of testing, we'll reduce the number of incidents.
And that's excellent advice from him. Louis?
Yes. Apparently, in China, a man went on a binge drinking session, drank 10 bottles of beer, did his best to hold in his wheeze for as long as he could. I don't know why. And then he's fallen asleep and his bladder has exploded.
Oh,
goodness me.
Oh. My goodness.
We don't hear of every day.
Yes. It wasn't a big binge, only 10 bottles.
Might be a small Chinese person. But everything's okay. He had emergency surgery and he is alive. They did save his life.
The doctors take the piss.
Good one, Brett.
All right, guys. Well, look, we're going to have to leave it there for the day. But thank you again for Paul for joining us today. Really informative and really appreciate having you on the show.
Fantastic. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, guys.
Have a fabulous weekend, guys. Enjoy your semi-non-lockdown at the moment.
Yeah. Thanks,
man. Cheers, everyone.
Bye.
Cheers.
See you later.
Bye. See you.